to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. The first update that I have is that I'm proud to announce that LQ Radio now has a full OGG feed for all audio. Now, we've supported OGG ever since the beginning, and any audio that's ever been made available at LQ Radio has always had an OGG with it. What I'm talking about here is for those of you that use a podcatcher with the RSS feed, there's now an OGG feed, so you can automatically download the unencumbered version of LQ Radio. There's a link to the OGG feed in the sidebar at the LQ Radio site, but automatically downloading the OGG is as easy as putting radio.linuxquestions.org/syndicate/lq-og.php into your favorite podcatcher. A quick update on the LQ Wiki. Participation in the LQ Wiki over the last couple of weeks has just increased tremendously. In some days, we're getting in excess of 50 to 100 edits, a ton of new content's being added. We have some very regular users who I'd like to thank, and they're doing an absolutely fantastic job. So if you haven't checked it out yet, go over to wiki.linuxquestions.org and join in. Now, on to the news. The first story that I'm going to cover is the contradictory nature of OOXML. And this started with Andy Updegrove continuing his excellent coverage of the OOXML standard approval process, and this is from one of his posts. Quote, regular readers will be aware that OOXML, the Microsoft Office XML-based format adopted by the ECMA, are now in the adoption queue at ISO/IEC. ECMA is a Class A liaison partner with ISO, which permits it to use the same fast-track process that the national standards bodies use. That process takes 6 months, the same amount of time that the PASS process takes, the route used by OASIS to submit ODF to ISO. As a sidebar, not part of the quote, ODF is also an ISO standard. But that has two steps rather than one, although the practical result is much the same. During the first one-month step, any member may submit quote-unquote contradictions, which, loosely defined, means aspects in which proposed standard conflicts with an already adopted ISO standard and directives. Those contradictions must be resolved, which does not necessarily mean eliminated, and those resolutions are then presented back to the members during the second stage to consider as part of the voting packet. During the second 5-month step, other objections, questions, and comments can be offered by members. For more detail on the rules relating to contradictions and what can be raised during this phase, see the excellent write-up at the Open Documentation Fellowship site. While the unprecedented size of OOXML at over 6,000 pages has made performing a detailed review a daunting task, more and more contradictions are being found by those that are slogging their way through on this very tight time frame. Here's a sampling of those that people have brought to my attention. End quote. If this is something that interests you, I definitely recommend that you go over and read the full post at Andy's blog, and it's a site I would definitely add to your RSS reader if this is a topic that interests you. From there, he goes on to detail some of the upcoming contradictions that have been or will be submitted. And like I said, you should read the full post, but this includes such items as reliance on the Windows platform, necessitating the implementation of undocumented Word bugs and other Office bugs, reliance on documentation that's not included in the 6,000-page draft, etc. In the end, I very much agree with Andy's statement, which is, quote, other contradictions would seem to be impossible to resolve given the nature of OOXML itself, the stated purpose of which is to describe a single vendor's products, bugs, rats, and all. End quote. And really, from my perspective, this format is not a community-developed standard that is meant to describe an Office document format, or actually, better put, multiple Office document formats. It's basically how Microsoft Office works, including bugs, without some needed information. Now, of course, that's not really a problem for Microsoft itself, given that their implementation of the spec is already done, and that's Microsoft Office. It does seem doubtful, however, that even Microsoft, given this spec, could write a fully compliant application, and that means no one else really stands a chance. Now, the upside for Microsoft here is that if this does pass, Microsoft will be able to keep the government contracts, which are increasingly requiring an open and standard document format, and also get some pretty decent PR out of it. And all the while, the standard almost certainly won't be fully implemented by any other product besides Microsoft Office. So, in my mind, not exactly how standards are supposed to work. Now, a follow-up story on the same topic was a post by Stefan Wally over on his blog, and he's an ex-Microsoftie via an acquisition, and I met him at the Desktop Linux Summit last year, and he's a very good guy. He makes some interesting observations about the current ODF OOXML situation, and this is from his blog post. Quote, I'm going to take a slightly different view here. ECMA has already approved the specification. One can imagine that the Microsoft marketing and standards engines are in full gear, and Microsoft execs, office spokespeople, and field account executives are faithfully espousing, 1. That Microsoft Office 2007 is standards compliant. ECMA International is a recognized international standards organization with participation from IBM, HP, Intel, Adobe, and dozens of other companies. Subtext, it must be a good standard for all our partners and competitors to have passed it in a fair-minded international standards process. And 2. Indeed, ECMA International has submitted the standard to ISO for fast-track approval as an international standard, and the process will be complete in 2007. Subtext, it's so good that they have recommended it for the fast-track at the world's premier standards body. I would be surprised if Microsoft's Massachusetts team isn't already lobbying to have the new standard included in that ITD reference, alongside ODF. Regardless of the merit of ISO accepting the document, however, buyers will be staring the nasty rhetorical beast in the teeth. So what is a procuring organization to do? End quote. He then outlines a certification process plan that I really think would serve ODF well. Hopefully something along these lines happens soon. And the time is obviously certainly of the essence here. And he concludes with something similar to what I said previously here, and that is, quote, standards with only one implementation aren't. The buying side of the marketplace has always recognized this and chosen the standard with multiple implementations over the specification with only a single implementation. The ODF world has the ability to demonstrate this message in a way that meets the needs of customers, and the demonstration through a branded certification is much more powerful than unaligned vendor rhetoric. End quote. And that's just absolutely spot on, in my opinion. The days of this kind of thing being accepted are thankfully coming to an end. Many companies and institutions have had to learn the hard way, to be sure, but they are learning. The next story I have is OSDL and the Free Standards Group will become the Linux Foundation. And first I'm just going to read a snippet from the press release. Quote, the two leading consortia dedicated to the advancement of Linux, the Open Source Development Lab, OSDL, and the Free Standards Group, FSG, today announced that they have signed an agreement to merge and form the Linux Foundation. The new organization accelerates the growth of Linux by providing a comprehensive set of services to compete effectively with closed platforms. Founding Platinum members of the Linux Foundation include Fujitsu, Hitachi, HP, IBM, Intel, NEC, Novell, and Oracle. Jim Zemlin, the former executive director of the Free Standards Group, leads the Linux Foundation. Other members of the new organization include every major company in the Linux industry, including Red Hat, as well as numerous community groups, universities, and industry end users. Computing is entering a world dominated by two platforms, Linux and Windows. While being managed under one roof has given Windows some consistency, Linux offers freedom of choice, customization, and flexibility without forcing customers into vendor lock-in, said Zemlin. The Linux Foundation helps in the next stage of Linux growth by organizing the diverse companies and constituents of the Linux ecosystem to promote, protect, and standardize Linux. The Linux Foundation, which continues to sponsor the work of Linux creator Linus Torvalds, employs a shared research strategy, much like open source development itself, to collaborate on platform development while enhancing the Linux market for end users, the community, developers, and industry. End quote. Now, the FSG and the OSDL had worked together on a variety of projects in the past, and while their area of focus has been a little bit different, they both have the same general goals and ideals. While they worked together on some things in the past, they previously had to compete with each other for membership and resources, which were becoming more and more scarce these days. The joining of the two companies should give the new entity more resources, with less overhead and less duplication of effort, and increased market influence. So overall, I think it's definitely a good move. I've even heard some people comment that they were surprised that it didn't actually happen sooner. The only downside I can see here is that previously the Standards Group, which was part of the FSG, was kind of a separate entity that didn't do a ton in the way of general advocacy or development, things of those nature, so it was kind of an independent standards group. Now, that independence is gone now, but it seems like a very, very small price to pay, and managed correctly, I don't foresee it being any problem whatsoever. Now, this story actually made the New York Times, and the Times article contained some verbiage that worried me a little bit, and this is a quote from the Times article. Quote, "And the mission of the new organization is to help Linux, the leading example of the open source model of software development, to compete more effectively against Microsoft, the world's largest software company." End quote. So why did that worry me at all? Microsoft really shouldn't be our main focus, at least in my opinion. And now, obviously, we should learn from what they do and be aware of what they're doing at all times, but improving Linux should really be the main goal. Now, luckily, that sentence seems to be an interpretation of the New York Times author, and outside of a quote in the press release, the word Microsoft is almost nowhere to be found on the actual Linux Foundation site, and they do mention things like successful proprietary software companies, but they don't mention any single company, and that's a generalization that I really like anyways. And the wording of everything on that site is in line with what I would expect of an entity focused on improving Linux and not on battling one specific company, which is fantastic to see. The stated mission statement they have and everything else on the direction of what they want to do is something that definitely looks fantastic. And while I'm kind of on the topic of this site, it's actually a great mix of MediaWiki and WordPress, and they've just brought those two packages together very nicely. I like the integration quite a bit, so kudos to whoever did that. Taking a quick glance at the people that are actually involved here, it's clear to me that this group should be able to pick up some traction rapidly and make some demonstrable differences fairly quickly. Now, as the press release stated, they are going to continue employing Linus, and the site did also mention a couple other people, so it doesn't look like there's going to be any reduction in force at this time, although OSDL did recently have some. Now, I encourage them to also try to work on the community participation. I know personally I'd offered my support and the support of LQ in general to the OSDL in the past, but after some initial talks, nothing really ever came of it. And the end reason was that they just really didn't have a spot for community participants in what they did. They were aimed more at the enterprises and companies joining, things of that nature. So I would hope to see that change with the new group. But that issue aside, and it's definitely not a big one, welcome to the party, and best of wishes and good luck. The last story I have is The Meaning of Free. And a recent blog post by Mark Shuttleworth of Ubuntu has sparked quite a bit of debate. Now here's his assertion, and this was posted to his blog. Quote, "We have to work together to keep free software freely available. It will be a failure if the world moves from paying for shrink-wrapped Windows to paying for shrink-wrapped Linux. As free software becomes more successful and more pervasive, there will be an increasing desire on the part of companies to make it more proprietary. We've already seen this with Red Hat and Novell, which essentially offer free software on proprietary terms. Their really free editions are not certified, carry no support, and receive no systematic security patching. In other words, they're beta or test versions. If you want the best that free software can deliver, a rock-solid, widely certified, secure platform from either of those two companies, you have to pay. And you have to pay the same price whether you're Goldman Sachs or a startup in Rio de Janeiro. That's not the vision we all share of what free software can achieve. With Ubuntu, our vision is to make the very best of free software freely available globally. To that extent, we make short-term compromises for drivers or firmware along the way. We see those as bugs and ones that would be closed over time." End quote. So basically, he's calling the two main enterprise Linux distributors proprietary companies. Now, Greg DeConisberg, who's the community development manager for Red Hat, which means obviously that he's quite active in the Fedora community, fires back. Quote, "You can call Red Hat proprietary all you want. That doesn't make it true. The difference between Red Hat Enterprise Linux bits and CentOS bits is virtually nil. We make all of our source RPMs available to anyone who wants them. Ask Novell if they do the same. I'll save you the time. They don't. What is proprietary is the brand and the quality of service you are entitled to receive by being a paying customer. Oh, and the notion that the price is same whether you're Goldman Sachs or a startup in Rio de Janeiro is ludicrous. If you want to duplicate that quality of service for Ubuntu users, that's noble and admirable. that's competition. But leave the fud at the door, dude. You're better than that, aren't you? End quote. And that was actually something that Greg had posted on his blog and as a comment on Mark's original post. The discussion really gets started from there. I'd recommend you head over to Mark and Greg's blog and see some of the discussion that's going back and forth if it's something that you're interested in. My opinion lies somewhere between the two, but of course that's not really surprising considering they're basically diametrically opposed and really represent each edge, so I would guess that most people's opinions fall somewhere in between. I do think that calling Red Hat a proprietary company is a bit disingenuous. As Greg pointed out, the bits are 100% freely available, and Red Hat is extremely active in contributing code back upstream, and it's something that they pride themselves with. And they've done well, in my opinion at least, in the open source community for a long time now. And it's certainly not like they haven't made mistakes, and I've even covered them, some of them here in the podcast and on my blog. I don't necessarily always agree with what they do, but I definitely don't think they're a proprietary company. I also don't think there's any real danger of there becoming a shrink-wrapped-only Linux situation. Well, Matt Acey got involved and seems to think that Mark doesn't get Enterprise Linux in a blog post of his recently. It's possible that he doesn't get Enterprise Linux, but I think it might be something else, though, and that's that Canonical, which is the commercial company formed around Ubuntu, has an entirely different business model. The Red Hat business model has turned into something along the lines of the following, and I do realize here that these are gross, gross oversimplifications, but they're really just meant to illustrate a general point. So theirs is, if you want Linux for free, we have a release that's primarily aimed at developers, that you are free in every sense of the word, gratis and libre, to do whatever you please with. The maintenance window is really, really short, and we make no guarantees, but here it is, enjoy. If you'd like a solid and stable version of Linux that comes with support from us, ISV certifications, and very long-term maintenance, we also have RHEL, but it costs. And that's how I'd sum up their business model. Regular listeners know that I've expressed my desire to have a maintenance without support version of RHEL, which would basically mean you'd get security updates and things of those nature without actual support, which is really more the costly side of it. For a fee, mind you, not for free, but just a much lower one. ES, I think, now starts at about $350, and I'd like to see something, you know, start at $60 and inquiry go down from there for maintenance without support. But that may never happen. Red Hat seems to be sticking to their business plan, at least for now. One humongous downside to this is that if you start with Fedora and kind of test and poke around, and that's your entry point, and then end up wanting RHEL or official support from Red Hat, you basically have to start 100% from scratch, wipe your boxes, install RHEL, and start from square one with your testing. So quite a bit of time could be lost. The Canonical version of a business plan seems to be more along the lines of, feel free to download any version of the products that we have, be it LTS or not. If you'd like support, we'd be happy to provide that for a price. And those not familiar with Ubuntu, LTS is their long-term support product that they guarantee to support for a minimum amount of time. This model does give companies the added advantage of being able to try the official product while maintaining the ability to easily move to the supported product from there with literally nothing, no reinstalls. You just call Canonical, tell them you want support, and you're supported. Now that is nice to be sure, but if you want anything in line of ISV certifications and things of that nature, at this time I'm not aware that Ubuntu has much to offer you, and that is important and definitely a deal breaker for some. To be honest though, the one great thing that really stands out here to me is that due to the way Linux is licensed and the way that open source works, both companies get a chance to prove their models. What's even better is that they're actually doing it with essentially the same bits. Sure, they have their own patches that they put in there, but essentially at the core, most of the code between these two are going to be the same. What that means is that everyone in the community really has the potential to win. No vendor lock-in on either side, so no comparisons to Microsoft of Linux. They're non sequitur, in my opinion. So this really underscores how great choice really is and how good the situation really is for consumers on this one. Just one final comment I'll add, and that's that Red Hat has done a very good job of proving that their business model works. They're, at this time, a profitable company. My question would be, can Canonical do the same with their model, and will they? That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.